This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Center for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
Hi everyone, this is Minnie. I'm sitting here with Professor Mike Garrett, who is the director of the Jodrell Bank Center for Astrophysics, and I'm terribly excited to be interviewing him today. Do you want to say hi, Mike?
Hi, guys.
So this is really cool because I believe that, Mike, you are the inaugural Sir Bernard Lovell Chair. Could you possibly tell us how you came to be in this esteemed position?
Well, I actually started here as a student, I guess, about 30 years ago, maybe 25 years ago. And so I did my PhD at Jodrell Bank and also worked a bit at the university. And then I left for 20 years. And I heard about this Sir Bernard Lovell chair, and basically it was an offer I couldn't refuse. Sir Bernard, well, he's a real legend in radio astronomy. To be the inaugural chair is really a bit of an honour, and one that I just couldn't refuse. So I'm happy to be back here and to have this position.
So did you actually get to work with Sir Bernard when you were a PhD student?
I didn't know. I only saw him from a distance, so I remember him walking along the corridors, and I was too scared to ever talk to him. Other people of my generation did, but I was always too scared.
So was he scary?
He was a bit scary, yeah. Sometimes he was. But once, I did go up to him once, and I got his autograph on one of his books, Astronomer by Chance. So I think that's the biggest interaction that I had, but of course I watched him and I saw what he did, and he was a very interesting man.
You should sell that on eBay. Worth watching. That's really exciting. So you said you did your PhD at Jodrell Bank, so these days PhD students are mainly based here in the Turing Building where we're recording today. Back in the day, you said you also worked at the university. How did it?
Well, I had a temporary lectureship here when I left. So I was working mostly here in the Schuster Building in Manchester, doing laboratories and doing some teaching. But yeah, I started off as a PhD student at Jodrell Bank, sort of living on site in one of the cottages there, which was a very interesting experience.
That's so cool. I love the site out there. But is it fun for PhD students, or does it get a bit old after a while?
Well, it has some advantages. You're right next to the telescope, so, you know, if you want to work 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, then you can do that. But yeah, after a while it's good to get into the city or to go home and be sort of enjoy pubs and all the clubs and all that kind of stuff.
I don't understand. It sounds like you're trying to tell me there's life outside of astronomy, and that's a concept not familiar to us.
Well, sometimes there is, yeah. So yeah, it was interesting to live there, and of course it was a very interesting time to be there. There was lots of activity. All the students were there, all the staff were there. Everyone was kind of intimately involved in what was happening with the radio telescopes.
And now everyone's here.
Well, I think there's also advantages to that. We have a much more diverse research portfolio, so we cover just about every topic in astronomy you can imagine. Whereas back then we were really focused on radio astronomy and the use of our own facilities. What I'd like to do, you know, in the future is bring back a lot of that engagement that we used to have between the telescopes and the researchers here in Manchester.
That's really cool. Hopefully we'll talk a bit about that later on. So I've also got written down here, you were director of Jive, Astron, and now JBCA. Is this a thing? Are you collecting directorships?
That's funny. No, I'm not collecting directorships, but my previous job as director of Astron in the Netherlands, I'd done that for 10 years, and I think that's long enough to be director, both for the person that has to do the job, but also the people in the institute. It's good that they have a change and someone with new ideas, so
I know the mood at Astron was quite somber that you had to leave, and certainly as I was a Jive postdoc, everybody talked very fondly about the years you were director there.
Yeah, no, I love being director of Jive because my real passion is VLBI, very long baseline interferometry, although I do a lot of other things, but VLBI has always been really important to me, and working at Jive allowed me to do the things which I thought were really important, which was to make VLBI much more accessible to everyone. That was really the thing that I focused on before I became director, and then eventually I became director only for a few years, in fact. I think I was only director for 4 years, but during that time we were able to push EVLBI, so we really got EVLBI working as a real tool for researchers, so that was really an exciting period.
So for our listeners that don't know, EVLBI is when you can do instantaneous VLBI, which typically isn't possible because of the large data rates and long distances. So typically we have to send our disks in VLBI, very long baseline interferometry, to a central correlator. And I don't know on Jodcast if I've actually talked about this. I love the EEVN. It's amazing, and it enables you to do VLBI on a much shorter time scale than previously available. So as you know, I love Jive.
Well, when we started on EVLBI, even I didn't think it was actually going to be possible.
Really?
No. Actually, the person who had the vision was Richard Scalizzi, who's actually here. I just kind of implemented the vision and got the money for the vision, in fact. So we got a lot of money from the European Commission, many millions, in fact, to do it. But at the start of it, I was kind of unconvinced that it was possible, because I worried about, you know, okay, you could maybe get two or three telescopes connected, but could you get all the European telescopes connected? That seemed quite difficult, because they have to be connected with optical fibers, and many of them are located in very sort of remote locations. But especially through the European funding, we managed to do that. We started at very low data rates, so about 32 megabits per second. And now I think we can do gigabits per second.
Right.
So I would never have dreamt that it would have happened so quickly, to be honest. But I always felt that if we could do it, it would be great, because we would get immediate results and immediate satisfaction, and we could be more experimental, because if we had detected sources, then we could modify the way we were going to observe them, etc. So I'm so happy it's worked out so well.
I love the EEVN, EVLBI, and as you say, accessibility was a big drive of yours, and certainly I find the EEVN to be the most accessible very long baseline interferometer that I personally used, so I'm a big fan of the EEVN.
Yeah, when we started the pipelining of data, I believe it was a little bit different from EVLBI, but I really believe you could pipeline VLBI data. But no one else believed that. So
why is that?
Well, I think it was just because, especially in the EVN, all the telescopes are a bit different. It's not sort of standard where you can think of each telescope being the same, like the VLBA in the US. So somehow there's always a sort of manual aspect to how you did VLBI data analysis, how you got the calibration of all the telescopes in the right format. So people didn't really believe it was possible. Even the guy who was working on it for me, who was Cormac Reynolds, who actually implemented the pipeline, he didn't believe he could do it. But he could do it, in fact, in the end, and that's the basis of the pipeline that's still used today.
Right, and it's a really amazing pipeline. Yeah. You can make preliminary images straight off the bat for the users.
I love it. I mean, I use it myself. You know, it's great for me because, well, I don't go to the images, but as long as I've got calibrated data, I can do anything.
So, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So you have a really broad breadth of research interest. I know you do, you've already said VLBI, I know that you're leading groups in the SKA, and I'm really interested in hearing you talk a little bit about SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Did you want to tell us a little bit about your research interest, please?
Yeah, when I did my PhD, I started doing optical spectroscopy. So I used a 4-meter telescope in Kitt Peak in Arizona, so I did a lot of that.
So you were based at Jodrell Bank, the like heart of radio astronomy in the UK, doing an optical PhD.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
So my supervisor was Dennis Walsh, who discovered the first gravitational lens, and one of the things we were doing was taking spectra for that project. So I really enjoyed that, and I really enjoyed Kitt Peak, I have to say. And the other aspect that I did was I did a lot of modelling, so writing computer software. So I was writing a lot of software on what were then sort of mini supercomputers, like the first Unix boxes, like the Alliant and Convex and things like that. So I became very sort of good and expert in computing, which has served me well through the rest of my career, actually, even as a director at some level. I even system managed computers at Jodrell Bank, so I did all the VAXes and the Unix machines and Sun workstations. And
I think I've heard of them.
they're kind of ancient, but really great machines. I was doing a lot, but one thing I was doing was also I'd gone into VLBI, and I quite liked the international aspects of VLBI, both in terms of the instrument is spread across a continent or many continents. That appealed to me.
So did you use the Kitt Peak VLBA antenna? Like, how did you get from optical to kind of...
Well, part of my PhD project was also to do very long baseline interferometry on these lensed quasars.
Right.
It was a sort of single object PhD, and the double quasar 0957+561A, B. That was my thesis, but it meant that I was doing lots of different things to try and understand more about that system and gravitational lensing. So I did VLBI on the images. They had radio emission. and that got me into the world of VLBI, and I think that broadened my horizons because I saw sort of VLBI as a high resolution imaging instrument that you could apply to anything. So as soon as I finished my PhD, I realized I didn't want to do much on gravitational lenses any longer. I'm kind of impatient. I always want to go into the next thing and I get bored really easily. So I didn't want to do lensing ever again, and I kind of moved on to more general radio surveys and using different radio instruments, but also using VLBI for galactic objects and extragalactic objects in the distant universe, high redshift, AGN, star-forming galaxies, all that kind of stuff. I also like mid-infrared astronomy.
You've done everything. I know at Jive you had the largest project that Jive had ever had to correlate.
Yeah.
With the EVN.
Yeah, I think I set records for a decade on that. And that was the idea of, normally when you do VLBI, you make very small, high-resolution images, but you only cover a tiny fraction of the sky.
Right, otherwise you have bandwidth smearing and things.
So I realized nearly 20 years ago that computing had developed so far that we had larger disks, we had larger processors, and that we could actually do better than that with VLBI. We could actually make the same size of images as the VLA or eMelon or whatever. And I didn't know if it would actually produce any science when I started along this route, but in fact, it did. So I was quite lucky, especially being able to detect very faint sources, which is something I really enjoy. I like the faint sources, not the bright sources, but the really faint ones.
So do you also use Melon and eMelon for your work?
Yeah, occasionally, yeah. But of course, I hope to do a bit more on that in the future. But yeah, no, I've used eMelon, especially in the past. Yeah.
So given your breadth of research interests, what would you say is the science result that you find most interesting or the one you're most proud of?
Well, in astronomy, there are a few sort of really kind of fundamental relations. So one of them is the far-infrared radio correlation, or the infrared radio correlation. And so that was first sort of discovered in the early 1970s, people looking at local galaxies and measuring how bright they were in the infrared and comparing that to the radio emission. They saw there was a very tight correlation for local galaxies, and that was extended over the years with bigger and bigger samples. And I guess what I'm most proud of is looking in the Hubble Deep Field to see if that relationship would hold for galaxies that were much further away. And so this was more like in the mid-infrared, so it was data from ISO, which was a satellite in the 1990s or so.
And I think you were using 24 microns for that?
No, we're using 15 microns, I think. And yeah.
I have read the paper, I promise.
Yeah. I definitely know we used 15 microns. So we showed that that correlation was still operating at cosmological distances, which was a bit unexpected in the sense. So it seems like this correlation just holds up no matter what the circumstances are, whether you're in the distant universe or the local universe, whether the galaxies are big or small. You know, they can even have AGN in them and they still show the far infrared radio correlation and the mid infrared radio correlation. So it's a bit of a puzzle, actually.
I wrote a paper about the far infrared radio correlation when I was doing my PhD. And then I wrote a poem about it, and I won a prize for the best student talk, humble brag, about the fine print radio correlation.
You're very good at poems, right?
But yeah, at least until when I followed this science, I think it holds out to redshift 3 or 4. It's well over two-thirds of the age of the universe. It's a cosmic conspiracy, as far as I understand.
Yeah.
That's really cool. So how did you get into the search for extraterrestrial intelligence?
I suppose I've always been interested in that. I think it was one of the topics that inspired me when I was a small kid. You know, the idea about life on other planets.
Are there aliens out there? Is there something you know that we don't?
No, definitely not. I don't know anything. I mean, maybe there are aliens out there, but I don't know if there are or there are not. So, I mean, definitely from an early age, I think that was one of the things that made me interested in astronomy. I've always been interested in it all the way through, but I only really started to kind of work on it in the last maybe 5-6 years or so.
So is this sort of waiting for a signal, searching for a signal, or are you working with people actively to broadcast a signal? How are we going to find out if there's life, or are we even going to contact any putative life out there?
Well, I've kind of been slightly associated with what's called communication SETI, so when you're looking for signals from extraterrestrial intelligences, but that's not really my main thing. What I'm more interested in is, in general, just looking for any kind of features or any kind of things that you might see in astronomical data.
So like transients?
Well, transients, for example, I think are extremely interesting. I've always said that, you know, the first SETI signal will not be detected by people interested in SETI. I think it'll be detected by pulsar astronomers or people that look at planetary transits, exoplanets. I think it'll come from somewhere else, and it won't come from actually the people that really want to detect it the most. So I think what I'd like to do is try and make people aware that when they look at astronomical data, they shouldn't just think that this is just some kind of physical system, that they shouldn't rule out that there might be some effects in there in the data that actually are due to the fact that there might be extraterrestrials that use a lot of power, or they transmit at certain frequencies, or they have megastructures around stars that gives you occultations, for example, when you look at planets, planetary systems. So I'd like people to think broadly and widely that maybe there's something out there that is a signature of advanced extraterrestrial intelligence, and that it actually sits in our data.
So it really is probing the unknown and not knowing what to search for, the unknown unknowns, I guess.
Yeah.
That's very cool.
We have a habit, you know, for example, in radio astronomy, we have lots of signals that we call radio frequency interference. And the first thing that we want to do is throw those out of our data, right? We try and get them out of their data, and we don't care what they are. You know, we just know that somehow it's not astrophysical, so we should get rid of it. So if you keep on doing that with astronomical data in general, then you can end up throwing away a lot of interesting stuff and maybe SETI signals.
Right. One astronomer's RFI is another's data. I think it's a long wavelength array. One of my friends was studying lightning, so he was looking at low frequency data at the long wavelength array in New Mexico, USA. And he was giving a talk, and one of the astronomers facetiously pointed to the Milky Way, which is very apparent in low frequencies, and said, "What's that?" And lightning physicist was like, "Oh, that's just RFI. We don't care about that. We get rid of it." So, you know, all of the galaxy was RFI to the lightning physicist, which I thought was quite cool. So do you think that the SKA will revolutionize our ability to search for extraterrestrial life?
Well, I think it's certainly a big step forward in terms of how deeply we can survey our own Milky Way, for example, and maybe even looking at other galaxies. So the problem with SETI, for example, is that we don't really know what we're looking for. That's a bit of a problem. And, you know, if we think we're looking for something like maybe we produce here on Earth, so the radio emission we produce from technology like radar systems, etc., we don't know how bright those things are going to be. And so every step forward in terms of sensitivity, or in terms of the frequency range, or how much time resolution you have in the data, you might be one step away from detecting that SETI signal. So every time you make a big step, I think it's certainly going to be interesting to see what happens.
Well, I have heard that, like, most of the big discoveries with the Hubble telescope were unexpected, unpredicted. So I'm assuming SKA is going to uncover so many things. How involved are you with the SKA as the JBCA director?
Well, I used to be very involved. I used to be on the SKA board, so I spent a lot of time on the SKA, especially when the big decisions were coming up, and I think I had a lot of input into, you know, thinking about the site decision, for example, for the telescope. So it was a very exciting time to be there and to be part of all of that. You know, there was a lot at stake for two host countries. So that was very interesting. I'm not on the board any longer now. I stepped down from that. But as director of Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics, we do have the SKA headquarters on our doorstep. In fact, I was just over there yesterday evening talking to people. So yeah, it's going to be part of my life in the future, that's for sure. And I'd like to try and make sure that we have good connections with them. And I think that'll be very important for making sure that not just Jodrell Bank, but the UK community as a whole has good access to the science coming out of the SKA.
That's very cool. So that kind of leads us into the other thing I wanted to ask you, which is kind of your vision for JBCA. I remember a colloquium you gave in New Mexico a couple of years ago, and the thing that really struck me, that stuck to my mind, was you were talking about, as director of Astron, how for you a priority was bringing the science and, you know, maximizing the science from the telescopes as opposed to merely running an observatory. What sort of things are you planning on doing here? Can you tell us a bit about that?
We have a fantastic instrument in the Lovell telescope, and one of the things we'd like to do is we'd like to really make it easier to combine together the Lovell telescope with the other telescopes that we run. So that would be very useful for pulsar observations, but also SETI observations, for example. You combine the power of all those telescopes together, so you have a very sensitive system. And we'd like to see the Lovell telescope enhance EMEL and the sensitivity there. And in fact, we'd like to upgrade that instrument so that it's more sensitive, that it has new receivers, maybe higher frequency receivers, for example, and can observe over a larger bandwidth. So these are all technical upgrades, but I'm very interested in seeing EMEL and what we do, actually reaching out to the community, letting the community know what a fantastic instrument that it is, and then actually servicing the community. So if, you know, someone has a good idea, we help them at all stages of the process. So when they try and prepare the proposal, when they get the data, helping them to analyse the data, just the kind of thing that we did in Jive a long, long time ago.
How you set up EVN
itself. EMEL and does that to some extent already, but I don't think enough people know about it, for example. And I think we can even do better than we do at the moment. We need more people to be able to do that, but I don't think it's impossible.
You were mentioning engagement between the telescope and research. That would be a huge boost for EMEL, and I think it's a fantastic instrument, but at least myself, I found it quite a sort of confusing instrument thus far.
It couldn't be any easier in the sense that I think VLBI as a concept and the way you have to analyse the data is much harder. So EMEL and data, I think we can do a good job in making it much more accessible to people.
So EMEL, and I mean, it's a connected element interferometer, which is very cool. And
yeah,
it kind of straddles the conventional interferometers like the VLA and VLBI, which typically aren't connected element interferometers. So
yeah,
I think that's very cool. Thank you so much, Mike, for joining us today and telling us a little bit about who you are and your vision for the University of Manchester's JBCA. I do have one final very important question for you. How often do you listen to the Jodcast?
I used to listen to it quite frequently. I've been a bit busy recently, but I'm going to tune in again after this interview, and I'm looking forward to hearing all these fantastic stories that you guys tell.
Very flattering. Thank you so much for your time, Mike.